Homebrewed Chef is brought to you today by the Cicerone Beer Certification Program. Professional credentials for people who sell and serve beer. Visit them online at cicerone.org. Buckle in your taste buds, foodies and beer lovers, and let Sean Paxton have his way with your mouth. This is the Homebrewed Chef.
Welcome to... Are we on?
Oh, yeah.
Here we go. Wow. Welcome to the Homebrew Chef with Sean Z. Paxton and my wonderful co-host, Justin Crosley.
Nice to be here with you, Paxy.
It's always great to see you, my friend.
Once we get everything working.
Tell ya.
Sometimes I forget how to use stuff in here.
This whole time change, you know, thing.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
It's dark outside, and I feel weird.
I know.
That's what happens.
I had a dark beer in my hand. It's crazy.
All right. It's good to be back on the Homebrewed Chef, though. And if I remember correctly, about this time last year, we were doing a big turkey day type of a show.
We were. A lot of fun stuff.
Yeah. And gave all kinds of details. Is it safe to say that we're in holiday mode now also?
I am in holiday mode.
Yeah? Okay.
I don't know about you, but I'm craving the holidays right now.
So this will be another show to gear us up for some holiday beer and food type of situations.
We're going to have a couple because there's that much to talk about.
Perfect.
There's all kinds of side topics, too, that we'll talk about. And yeah, it's been fun. It's, we've been incredibly busy lately. A lot of fun stuff been going on, and we'll do a little wrap-up of that stuff, and then we'll talk all kinds of ideas to get you guys all honed in for lots of celebration.
Perfect. Yeah, I do know that it's just kind of wrapping up, festival season for us, which means kind of beer dinner season for you. So you must have a lot to tell us about in that regard.
Oh, the fall is just crazy.
Yeah.
Everybody wants to do something.
Of course. Yeah. Do something with
the
packs.
Hey, I got this new beer. Hey, I got this going on. Hey, I got that going on. Hey, what about this? And, oh, let's throw a GBF in the middle of it. And, hey, let's do, you know, that.
Yeah. So, yeah.
A lot of good stuff.
Fun stuff.
But it's been great. So no complaints.
All right. Well, today's show, of course, is brought to you by our good friends over at the Cicerone Beer Certification Program. You can go to cicerone.org and check it out. And our good friend Ray Daniels runs the program over there. And certified beer servers, certified beer Cicerones. Check it out over at cicerone.org, and you can get all the information you need. It'll help your palate. That's for darn sure. And if you're in the beer serving world, it'll help you even more as a professional.
And if you happen to go to a restaurant where they don't know anything about beer, you should drop Cicerone, because I just did that the other day.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, because they had a couple beers, but server didn't know how to pour them. Beers weren't kept right. The glassware wasn't rinsed properly. I mean, it was pretty atrocious. And if they had served wine that way, people would have been very upset.
Right.
And
but it's okay to serve
it's
beer.
It's okay.
That
yeah,
way.
No big deal. And again, you know, I shake my head. It's just like, you know, how do we become the bastard stepchilds of, you know, the beverage industry? You know, I mean,
yeah.
It's okay to put three subpar, you know, pilsners together.
Right.
But a sommelier would never put three sub, you know, par Chardonnays or Cabernets together and think that that's okay. I don't get it. So, yeah, I really applaud what Ray keeps doing, and you know, it's been fun. Actually, I just wrote an article for Culinary Trends magazine talking about, you know, proper storage of beer, proper glassware, you know, and really referenced Ray a lot, because a lot of the stuff comes right out of his stuff. And,
yeah.
You know, he's got all these great tests going on all over the country, so you can get certified if you're interested.
Yeah.
Look at his dates. They got a whole bunch up there. And
he's paving the way for this to kind of brighten up.
We so need it, because, you know, if people don't know beer and they don't know how to store it, they don't know how to serve it, they don't know how to pour it or recommend it, you know, it's a travesty.
Yeah, yeah.
It doesn't make anybody any better, because, you know, I don't want it to be like, you know, when you go to the beverage selection at BevMo and you look at wine and you kind of get lost.
Yeah.
That's the last thing we want with beer, because,
right,
you know, we want to help people understand it, you know, and, you know, with all my talks, you know, I've talked to a lot of different people in the industry on the food side, and they really need help. Right. That's why we do the show. So
sure.
To provide a guiding light.
Well, definitely, it's good advice that you say. If you go to a place that's kind of failing in that department, you certainly don't have to be rude, but recommend Cicerone and say, you know, if you end up talking to the manager especially, go, you know, something that'll really help your servers out and help your beer selection here is to have a certified Cicerone in here.
Yeah, and it was fun because the beverage manager at this one restaurant, he's kind of like, what is a Cicerone? And when I started to talk about it, he kind of perked up a little bit because he was like, huh, I should know about that.
Yeah, absolutely.
And he should.
All right. Well, thank you to Cicerone for sponsoring the show and allowing what's about to happen because without sponsors, we couldn't really do this program. So we do appreciate it. Now, we have gotten back in the studio here amongst tons of different beer dinners I know that Sean's been doing. So tell us just a little bit about what's been going on.
Lots of fun stuff, and we've been playing with some really cool products. And for all you guys who like that meat show that we did way back when, we did some really fun stuff with the Sierra Nevada, and actually just about ready to get a whole bunch of stuff to push to work on a fun little video of Brian Grossman and I playing with pigs. We did some really fun stuff where we had two swines that were raised on spent grain, spent hop, and spent yeast from Sierra Nevada, and we injected them with one with Life and Limb 2, the collaboration beer with Dogfish Head and Sierra, where it actually uses the maple syrup from Sam's farm, family farm, is actually in the beer.
Nice.
And the other one, we use the first runnings of Celebration. So, 'tis the season. And we cooked those up separately, and yeah, you'll be able to see the whole thing. We took video of it. You actually were taking video and stuff, and so yeah, it was fun. So we'll be sharing all that. That was at the Northern California Homebrew Festival for about 165 people, 175 people.
Yeah, I got to dive in there and rip that pig apart.
Yeah, you were.
It was cool.
Gnarly.
It was cool, man.
That was fun, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a good time. I didn't think I'd be into that sort of thing, but it was pretty cool. And then the food was just amazing. You know, I'd never had, I've had pulled pork before and things like that, but I've never had that kind of a roasted pork, like one that was buried and you did the other one on the spit. And, it was something else just to be a part of and to see how it works. And then, that meat, the way it just came off the bone was pretty incredible.
Well, what was really fun for me too was that was actually the first dinner where I just did, pale ales, IPAs and double IPAs. And to really think about lupulin threshold and, you know, it was the one thing that I always was worried about, you know, because here's, you know, what was it, 8 really amazing beers that are all very hop forward. And, you know, we had Marin there, we had 21st Amendment there, we had Firestone there, we had Sierra there, we had, you know, Sutter Buttes, we had a lot of great beers, and Bracer 5, you know, and all these great beers that all had a place because they are so different, even though they're all in the same style.
Yeah.
And actually, if anything, we're really able to, with the food, to make those beers stand out even more. The Sutter Buttes IPA that they had, it was one of the last beers that Peter Hoey brewed professionally. And really great beer because it has all these tons of tropical passion fruit, mango, papaya notes to it. And we used that in a IPA ceviche that was just really brought out the halibut just beautifully and really fun. But then, you know, to switch gears and do, you know, Hoptimum with one of these pigs and how big that beer was, but yet it wasn't too bitter.
Yeah.
You know, and the food really balanced everything out so that at the end of the meal, even with dessert, we did a Union Jack marshmallows for a homemade graham cracker that was made with cinnamon and orange peel and, you know, kind of a little different with dark chocolate in there to make a camping s'more since we're kind of camping up there in Lake Francis Dobbins area.
Yeah.
And it was kind of a fun marshmallow. It was kind of a little bit bitter, a little bit more on the orangey side, and the orange chocolate kind of really played it up with the pairing. It was really fun.
It was nice. At one point, I was, and I don't remember why, I drank a couple beers that day.
What?
At some point, I was walking around with a bunch of that marshmallow in my pocket. Like, I just had this marshmallow in my pocket and was chewing on it at random moments because it was really nice. It had this nice, like a subtle, fresh orange flavor to it. And I don't know, someone just came and handed me a bunch of it, and I didn't have anywhere to put it, so I just ended up walking around with this marshmallow in my pocket.
That scene in, I forget the movie, but you know, it's like, hey, you want a gummy bear? It's been in my pocket. It's so warm.
I felt very strange, but it was fun.
No, it was a really fun dinner, and again, it's just, it's always fun for me because, you know, to experiment, to play around, to take a thought, a process, and prove it right or wrong, and you know, to be able to make it into a positive. And I really think that all those beers and how they showcase the hops in so many different ways, and, you know, since we love the hops so much. So
yeah, beautiful.
Yeah, that was really fun. And then actually, it was just recently down in Hollywood. That was kind of fun. Mm-hmm. Down there with Firestone Walker, we did the Deconstructed event, which was the first release of Firestone's anniversary beer, 15, this year.
How did that go? I heard about that event.
It was a blast. We did it at the Avalon Theater, which was across the street from the Capitol Records building, so right there downtown.
Yeah.
Great venue, great space, real kind of Moroccan, French kind of thing. So we worked that into the menu. Really did some neat stuff because 8 beers went into this year's blend. And, you know, that beer this year is just incredible. It's so layered with so many different components. And how to really showcase and really deconstruct what that beer is was kind of my challenge. And it was kind of an interesting take on what do you do food-wise to go with the venue, food-wise to go with these huge beers. I mean, we're talking, I think, about like the lowest alcohol beer we had, I think it was 10%. And they went all the way up to 14.5%.
Wow.
And so you think 8 courses with that, plus like a little, you know, reception kind of thing going on. And it was just really a blast to really showcase the different beers and all the different flavors because, you know, each beer brings its own nuance and its own kind of personality to that blend. Mm-hmm. But to break it down, you know, all the way through the dinner until the last beer that we tried was a 15, and I didn't even need to pair anything with it because I really wanted it just to be a standalone beer and really showcase all those flavors that
good
all combined together.
Yeah.
And it was really a blast. And
see, that's why you're a great chef, Paxton, because, and I mean this just in a genuine way, if I was a dinner goer, if I was there that night, I really would have appreciated that this chef making all of these fantastic pairings all throughout the night made the decision at the end to go, and now your featured course is the beer. As a beer guy and a, you know, struggling foodie, I would have really appreciated that. I think it's a really good choice on your part. Now clearly, if the beer was a Pilsner, that might not have been your choice, but his anniversary beers are so complex with 8 to 10 different beers mixed in. I think that's one of the reasons I think that makes you such a good, it makes such a good experience about going to your dinners, because that's a decision making process that not every chef would go through, you know.
Well, thank you.
It's a really good decision.
Well, and it's fun for me because it helps people become more educated. It helps people become more aware of what they're tasting, because I didn't really want to clutter that, because that was really the crescendo of the event.
Is that
beer, I mean, that's the whole reason why we were there. And with the food that I was able to pair with each of the beers, it was really unique because I was able to really pull out different flavors of those beers to really highlight what they brought to the blend.
So that even I feel like that, because I am following now, I really wish I was there. I can just imagine that after you kind of showcasing all these different flavors, that the beer, even though you didn't pair it with a dish of yours, it still would have enhanced the dishes that I just had. It's still part of the meal, and it would have made me more excited about the meal, even though I wasn't having more food with it, you know?
And it really brought it all full circle, because I could have actually paired every single course with 15 if I wanted to.
Right.
But doing it this way, it really became the roadmap, you know, and at the end of the roadmap was, boom, your destination, and the destination was the 15.
This beer, yeah.
And it was really a blast, you know, working with, you know, Matt Brendelson and David Walker and Jamie Smith down there. We really had a blast. And
very cool.
A lot of fun people down there at the Avalon. They really helped out a lot, and we had a great crowd of people. You know, Dr. Bill was there. We had Zane Lamfrey was there, Mr. Three Sheets.
Yeah, I saw that. Very nice.
And we even had Phil was there from My Life as a Foodie, and actually I highly recommend you check out his blog and podcast, because he did a really nice wrap-up. We did a little bit of audio together, and he had a blast.
Very cool.
It was really fun for him to be there and try the food and the beer, and I think his impressions were really fun to listen to. I really enjoyed it, because it's always interesting to me to hear somebody else's perspective, because I know what I put into it, but
yeah,
is it, you know, received on the other end, and how is it received? And you know, I think some of the pairings were edgy and crafty at the same time, you know, to be successful, you know, because that's really what I try to do. And you know, when there's 175 people there and we really want to kick it up a notch and, you know, make it something that people will talk about, you know, especially with a beer week like LA Beer Week, you know, we really want to put that signature stamp, like, this is the event you want to go to. And that's what people said after the week was done.
So, yeah, yeah.
A lot of fun.
Well done, sir. Well done.
And then we had GABF.
Yep. Another big event.
Maybe you've heard of it.
You didn't do any dinners out of GABF, though, did you?
I did a presentation.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Yeah, I was there talking about food and beer, and we did a fun little scavenger hunt to actually get Will Myers and Tanya Cornett to go out in the field of beer, and 2,400 beers were being poured, and they had to choose what to pair with the two dishes I came up with, which was a... Alaskan smoked porter beef stew, mm-hmm. that was real seasonal, and that recipe should be up on craftbeer.com shortly. And we also did a pumpkin biramisu, and that was real fun with Weyerbrocker's Imperial Pumpkin Ale, and doing a twist off the tiramisu, but without using espresso and rum. We use beer.
Nice.
And actually, Rogue chipped in, and they got some of the hazelnut spiced rum that they make.
Oh, yeah.
And we used that with the beer, and it was actually a really nice combo. You added that little nice toasty, you know, nuttiness to the pumpkin ale, which is kind of a fun twist, you know, when you think about a pumpkin pie or pecan pie, and
yeah.
Wanted to play that up with the beer misu, and really kind of a nice fall, you know, representation of stuff that's pretty easy to make ahead and serves a lot of people, and, you know, those entertaining things.
Yeah.
So those will be some fun recipes up on craftbeer.com shortly.
Very cool. Craftbeer.com is a great resource for that stuff,
too. And they got a lot of stuff going on that, so it's been kind of fun.
Well, it's been a busy year. It's time to unwind a little bit and get back into the show. We'll do a couple of holiday shows. Part one is right now. Part two is coming up next, so just stick with us. First, as always, we'd like to cover a little bit of feedback on today's show.
Feedback.
You can always send your feedback to homebrewedchef@thebrewingnetwork.com. It goes straight through to Sean that way, and he tries to answer as much as possible. If we don't do it on the air, I know he tries to get back to you personally through email, too. But please send it in, because we love getting questions. All right, first Thomas writes in, "Hey, Sean, I was thinking of making a triple mushroom soup, something with like shiitake, portobello, and maybe oyster mushrooms. I haven't decided on the shrooms just yet, but I wanted to infuse a beer and maybe some hops into the soup. At first, I was thinking a porter or an oyster stout would go nice, but then the hops and an IPA came to mind with their earthy and grass notes. I thought it would complement the fungi well. So let me know your thoughts and some suggestions on a beer." And then, of course, what's the best way to add beer to the soup?
Great question. Thomas, it's a really interesting thing because there's so many different angles you could take with this, and it all kind of depends on the mushrooms you're using. The shiitake, you know, have a lot of woodsy earthiness to them, where the portobello is definitely very earthy, depending on the size of them and how old they are, because sometimes I actually like to let my mushrooms kind of get almost to that point where you want to throw them away. And that's almost what makes the best mushroom soup.
Okay.
So they're almost starting to get kind of slimy.
Really?
But that's where they get all that really great flavor. And so that's kind of fun. And then the oyster mushroom has a very clean, very delicate flavor, you know, versus a chanterelle. Or, I mean, there's so many different kinds of mushrooms. And so this is what, you know, is kind of fun because, you know, just the button mushroom is kind of boring in a weird way. But so if you want to go, you know, a porter works well because there is that roast component, mm-hmm. and that roast really brings out some interesting flavors in the mushroom because it starts to touch on some of the umami, because think about mushrooms full of umami, and, you know, it's that fifth food group, if you will, and, you know, you really kind of almost feel it more on the top of the roof of your mouth. And with that, you know, you think about coffee and like when you sip coffee and how that kind of flavor layers in there. Another one that's really fun with mushrooms is like a Bock or a Doppelbock. That Munich malt really comes through nicely with mushrooms. It layers in a not overly sweet flavor, but it adds in a lot of complexity. You know, IPAs are interesting to cook with. The grassy notes and the earthy tones of the hops, especially those varietals, more your noble hops and stuff, not your new varieties nowadays that are all so citrus forward and you know, it's interesting when you think about how those flavors really come through, and it's not really from the malt, but it's from the hops, and the hops are very volatile. So if you do add that beer, I would add it at the very, very end, and I'd be very careful about how much you add. And depending on your recipe, you could do a couple different things where you caramelize some onions or shallots or roasted garlic first, and that's going to add a base sweetness. And then you're going to have all your mushrooms. And this is also a good place, too, to actually add some dried mushrooms. Porcini are kind of fun. You could also do dried oyster. Morel, I think, are wonderful, especially with a Doppelbock. They work really very complementary. And the pairing would be kind of a fun way, too, because then you have several different options. You know, if you go with more of a porter, you know, you could do like a coffee stout to pair with it.
Yeah.
Good idea. You know, if you do the Doppelbock, you know, you could easily do like a Vienna lager. You could do a Märzen, you know, for that smooth and the seasonality of it. Those would be fun as well. So,
okay.
But definitely, you know, as far as, you know, you don't really need to reduce the beer. I would actually, you know, if you're worried about the bitterness, you could actually add some cream too. That's going to kind of balance it out and kind of smooth and those rough edges and kind of smooth those edges out. But you would just cook, you know, basically saute your onion, shallots, garlic, add in maybe a little bit of rosemary or thyme, depending on what you're doing. Rosemary with IPA would work really well with that resiny component. And then basically go right in and, you know, deglaze with a smoked porter. A porter would work really well, or the Doppelbock. And then add the cream in, you know, after you've sauteed the mushrooms and stuff. And then, boom, puree it up if you want, or keep it chunky.
Okay. Thanks for writing in, Thomas. Trevor writes in, "Hello, Sean. I have a quick question for you about beer-braised short ribs.
My favorite.
And the style of beer to braise with it. I was thinking about using a Bock beer because the maltiness seems to be a good choice. However, I've done some research and keep seeing stout as the style to use. I don't want to use a stout for the dish, though, because I don't want to pair it with a heavy beer. So would a Bock beer be a good style for the dish?" And he says he could have emailed you the recipe if you want, but I bet you can extrapolate what you need just from this, couldn't you?
So, Trevor, great question, because it is true. I mean, you see stout and imperial stouts used all the time to braise the short rib. And, you know, since a short rib is a cut of meat that has a lot of marbling to it, it's a pretty fatty piece, which is nice, so it doesn't dry out. And the longer it kind of braises, you know, which is a perfect braising cut of meat, it's not the best to have, like, seared rare. And what's fun is when you think about these flavors and how, you know, the stout has that roastiness and it has some sweetness but not too sweet. You know, a Bock is a good choice. It is a little on the sweeter side, though, so you have to think about that a little bit, depending on your aromatics, you know, your onions, your celery, your carrots, that kind of stuff that you might want to braise it with, you know, some bay leaf, that kind of thing. But I think an alt beer would be kind of a fun twist, or an amber beer would also work really nice, because that's going to have a little bit more hoppiness. But those are actually going to be less heavy, rich, full-bodied beers in comparison. So that would kind of lighten it up a little bit. You know, even, you know, the Sierra Nevada Tumbler, that's a beer that I think would work awesome. You know, that brown ale is just such a fun beer to cook with. I've really enjoyed that beer. And, you know, Nectar Ales is hemp ale. That's a brown as well. That would work really nice.
Okay.
So those are some good choices.
All right. Thanks for writing in, Trevor. And Donnie writes in, "Sean, thanks so much for your show and website. You've given me so much inspiration. Last night I made mashed sweet potatoes and buttermilk cornbread, both using Rogue Chipotle ale, and they were fantastic. Also, I have a chicken beer brining for tonight."
Oh, and now we didn't even get invited.
Exactly.
In
prep for the holidays, though, I was just listening to your Thanksgiving and holiday show again from last year. You talked about Three Philosophers cherry cranberry sauce on the show. Can you provide a recipe for that? I made the wit version last year and would like to try this one.
Well, that recipe is actually in Beer Advocate, and that's in the last holiday Thanksgiving issue.
Great magazine.
Have to check that out, because that was a real fun recipe. And since they, you know, they have it. We're working to do a few things with that, but hopefully you can go back through and find it or ask a friend if they have a copy of that magazine.
Okay. And do you write in every Beer Advocate magazine?
Yeah, for the last almost 5 years.
All right. Get yourself a subscription to Beer Advocate magazine. I recommend it even without PAX in it, but PAX in it is like the icing on the cake. It's a good mag.
But there's Lisa Morrison. There's Drew Beecham. There's Andy Crouch. I mean, there's a lot of great people in there, and there's new stuff all the time.
Check it out. All right, and then another question is, can you provide any insight into cooking with Belgian candy syrups? Cup for cup, are they sweeter than sugar? I just ordered a few varieties to experiment with, he says.
Well, there's a couple different products that they use over at Dark Candy, and, you know, Brian is a great guy, and I'm so thankful that he brought these sugars over because they're not quite... cup for cup, when you look at the soft sugars, so we're kind of almost talking about like a brown sugar equivalent. There's a blonde and a brown. What's fun with them is that they don't have that molassesy, mapley kind of undertone. I get much more of a chocolate vanilla to them. So I really enjoy those. Are pretty much a 1-to-1 ratio. For substituting for sugar or brown sugar in recipes. The other product that they offer is the liquid syrup, which is the candy syrup that we've, you know, rock candy was a big thing, and everybody thought it was rock candy that they were brewing with. But in return, it's actually after they make the rock candy, there's a liquid left still full of sweet, you know, sugars. And they actually reduce that very low and slow. And it's not quite a caramel. It's not really quite a syrup. I mean, even though it is kind of like a syrup, but it doesn't really crystallize. And so with that long cooking process, there's the D, the D2. The D2, I get huge amounts of dried fruit out of it. In brewing, it's just wonderful for like a double or a quad, really adds a lot of complexity. But in cooking, you could use that like honey because it is going to be sweeter. You could do it like molasses as well. So that would be almost a 1-to-1. And it's all depending on, you know, you might want to taste it. And you could always go a little less at first and then add some in just depending on what you're making. If it's a cake or, you know, a stew, if you're adding a little bit of sweetness in there, you know, a carbonade kind of a thing, you could use a little bit there with your onions. It'd be kind of nice.
Okay. Sounds good.
Yeah. God, I'm getting hungry already.
All right. Doug writes in, kind of a long one. Let me see if I can do this quick as possible. Hey, Sean, 2 years ago, I started a new family tradition. I'm horrible at finding gifts for the family, so instead of getting a cheesy gift this year, I thought I'd present them a gift through cooking Christmas dinner. Wanted to make a dinner that I knew that no one in my family had experienced and let them live like kings for a night. So the first year, I did pork Wellington, which is fun and really wowed the family. Last year, I did a crown roast, which is something I have never seen in my 26 years, along with the rest of my family. I know it sounds like we live in a cave, but it's not that often that you casually buy a $90 piece of meat. Also, last year, I used a lot of your recipes from the Christmas episode, which really impressed the meal. So, let's see. By the way, now his family looks at Christmas in a whole new light, and food's a big part of it. So he said, I really would like your help on some ideas for this year's dinner. I'm already planning to do last year's recipe for prime rib as the main course. After that, without repeating any of last year's dishes, I'm in the dark. So he says he's been scouring the internet for new ideas anything new to do, but haven't really found much. So I have recently purchased a sous vide temperature controller.
Woohoo!
That will also double as a temp controller for mashing in my brewing. That's efficiency. I like to hear that. Get the cooking and the brewing ware to work double duty, right?
Dun, dun, dun.
So he's looking for ideas and maybe a few sous vide ideas.
Well, first off, I think this email just brought just a huge smile to my face, Justin. It was really cool because, you know, that's the whole reason why we do this show is to give people a different approach, an alternative. And I think, what a better gift. I mean, you know, I think he really says it well, you know, as far as something cheesy versus, you know, just a great meal and a good just evening together. I mean, sometimes that's all it is. You know, it's just slowing down, have a great dinner together. And what comes out of a great dinner?
Yeah.
I mean, if it's a shitty dinner... I've been there and it's like, oh man, it kind of ruins my evening. But on the flip side, when it's really good, and you know, that's why I do a lot of this stuff, is to really help, you know, that happen. And how cool is it that I'm a part of his dinner? So
very
first
cool.
off, just really thank you. On the sous vide side, oh man, it's endless. I mean, there's so many different things you can do here. You know, beef tenderloin works really well. You know, if you have a controller unit, which is pretty important with the sous vide, depending on what you're cooking, the whole idea with sous vide is basically it's a water bath. So water is 26 times more dense than air. And if you think about when we cook over a stove with using flame, you're only really cooking one side. And as you're cooking it, you know, when you cook a steak, let's say, and you're searing the steak in a saute pan, you know, it's that high heat, you know, and is a pan 300, 400, 500, 600 degrees, depending on where you have that knob dialed in. And, you know, it's basically overcooking the outside, you know, exterior, and then it's overcooking it all the way through until the interior is properly cooked. And then you flip it, you know, and then you're doing the same thing. So half the meat, you know, and that's why you let it rest to redistribute the juices. Where in sous vide, you're cooking in a vacuum seal bag, so it's cooking in its own juices. And then what's happening is it's cooking on all sides all the way through, but at a very much like temperature that's like 100, like for me, a steak at 131 degrees Fahrenheit is just awesome. And you could cook it in there for about 2 hours, and it's cooked all the way through. And then at the very end, all you do is you just basically splash, you know, a little bit of olive oil or butter into a really hot cast iron pan and just sear it for like 30 seconds to a minute on each side just to get that Maillard reaction to kind of do that nice little crust that we like so much on a steak.
Yeah.
And so if you do like a... You could do, depending on how you have like a vacuum option, and you can always talk to your butcher because they usually have a vacuum seal or cryovac bags. And if you season it, you can actually pop in that meat, like let's say a tenderloin, and maybe some thyme, some rosemary in the bag, vacuum seal it, and then cook it for about 2 hours at like 131 degrees, and then get like a large, like... not really a saute pan, but like a large skillet or a flat top. You can get like those cast iron flat tops that you can cook like pancakes on and stuff.
Yeah.
Like a griddle. Get that real smoking hot and then just roll it and sear it and then let that rest and then do that with like a wild mushroom gravy over the top. You could do like a brown ale tomato sauce, you know, instead of something chunky, you know, like that. You know, I've done demi-glaces, you know, where you can take the demi-glaze and you can actually reduce it down until it's ready and then do a nice splash of barley wine or imperial stout or even some of these holiday beers right now I think are really going to be fun. Like Anchor Christmas is a fun one with all those great flavors that that has, you know, that roastiness that's always kind of there. But then the, depending on the spicing, if it's evergreen or whatnot, that would work really well as well.
Okay.
So that's one option. And then the other one is duck. Put some beer, like I love Consecration in the duck legs, and boom, it's a great combo. And just cook it low and slow, like 180 degrees for like 8 hours.
Beautiful.
But the real trick is to keep that temperature as consistent as possible.
Okay.
But for all you guys who don't have a sous vide unit and you have a large brew pot...
You could do it that way.
You could do it that way, and you just have to really watch the temperature and try to keep the flame off on, and try to keep it as close to that 131 degrees or 135 degrees, depending on how you like your steak. Medium rare.
So a little more difficult, but doable.
A little bit, but I've done it before. It works because you have like, you know, 10 gallons, 15 gallons of water.
Yeah, okay.
And that will really help as far as, you know, especially if you have it insulated with a nice shell.
Okay.
You know, it works really well.
All right, great ideas, and keep that family tradition up. I love family traditions, especially revolving around food. Good stuff.
Yeah.
All right, let's take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll get into some more holiday cooking on part one here of this year's holiday show. Hang in there.
When I order a beer, I want my server to know more about it than I do. I want someone who enjoys good beer and loves helping others enjoy it too. I want someone who knows how to pour a perfect pint for any beer style. I want a Cicerone. The Cicerone certification program is creating the type of people who help you enjoy great beer. Home brewers and craft beer lovers know beer is more flavorful and complex than ever, and it takes some serious knowledge to store and serve beer right. Cicerones know beer. There are three levels in the Cicerone program: Certified Beer Server, Certified Cicerone, and Master Cicerone. Cicerones are truly the sommeliers of beer. The best beer locations have a certified Cicerone on staff. Relaxed and and unpretentious. Cicerones are tested on storing and serving beer, beer styles, flavor and tasting, the brewing process and ingredients, and pairing food with beer. Learn more about your next beer guide at Cicerone.org. Certified Cicerone, because it takes top talent to present a perfect pint.
A heretic is anyone who does not conform to an established attitude, doctrine, or principle.
If you love craft beer, you're already a heretic.
The very first thing we did when we started looking at the beers that we would brew, we got rid of all those recipes. We started from scratch. We've been pilot brewing the most creative things that we could think of and the most interesting things. We've completely gone away from style.
Heretic Brewing Company is opening this spring in Pittsburgh, California, and you can be a part of it. Visit hereticbrewing.com and facebook.com/hereticbrew. Get the latest updates on the brewery and upcoming beers. Show everyone how you celebrate great beer as a heretic.
It's a fairly powerful word. Being a heretic, that means you're not settling for ordinary beer. You are going with flavorful, creative, bold, interesting beers. A heretic is looking for the best beers out there.
Be a heretic. Don't drink ordinary beer.
In the past year, the Brewing Network has been able to add two new shows, expand our studio capabilities and quality, and bring more beer information home to you than ever before. In no small part, this is due to subscribers like you. Thank you from all of us at the Brewing Network. Without your monthly support of any denomination, we could not bring you the very best in live beer radio like Can You Brew It?, Brew Strong, and The Sunday Session. Haven't signed up yet? Join your fellow brewers in the BN Army. Sign up today at thebrewingnetwork.com for a recurring donation as little as $2 a month. Besides all the great live radio you'll support, every subscriber is automatically entered in monthly raffles for amazing brew gear like a conical fermenter, a temperature control system, or your own draft setup. Become a part of the BN Army today.
Now, more triple bacon wrapped bacon with bacon demi-glaze from the home-brewed chef.
All right, welcome back to the program, and thanks for sticking with us here on The Homebrewed Chef with Sean Z. Paxton. And once again, it's time to get started thinking about your holiday meals, and who better to help us do that than Paxton?
Welcome.
All right, so why don't you tell us what are we doing on the table this year, Paxy?
Well, we got a couple weeks, you know, trying to think a little bit about what's up and coming, and this is a really good time to start planning and strategizing what you're going to do for that main course. You know, to me, turkey is kind of synonymous with Thanksgiving.
You know,
how often do you have a roasted turkey?
Never. Thanksgiving.
You know, you have a turkey sandwich maybe for lunch here and there, and, you know, you have...
it's not the same, is it?
It's not.
Yeah, and even the turkey sandwich you have after Thanksgiving is much different than the turkey sandwich you have the rest of the year. It's
it's
a real turkey.
It's heavily processed.
Yeah.
It's a real thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's interesting when you really stop and think about our heritage. You know, you look at Plymouth Rock and you look at, you know, the Founding Fathers and you look at some of the first Thanksgivings we had, and really, what did they find? I mean, they're really foraging, you know, and you think about, you know, going out in the woods and seeing what you can find that's actually edible. And, you know, this is kind of a fun thing that's kind of been on the foodie side. And, you know, there's been a lot of people doing it, you know, where they go into Golden Gate Park and they find all these little things, you know, miner's lettuce and all these other things that are really tasty stuff. But I will say, if you don't know what you're eating or you don't know what you're picking, disclaimer here, beep, beep, beep.
Especially when it comes to mushrooms.
Especially comes to mushrooms, because a lot of people die. It just kills your liver. And I don't know about you, but I like drinking beer.
You're either going to die or have a really wild night. And I don't really recommend either if you're not prepared for it.
Flashback. Wait, what?
Yeah.
But this is also where you can really find a lot of things, even in your backyard. Like, I have miner's lettuce grown in my backyard.
Really?
I know what it is. I know what to look for. And it's kind of a fun thing. And so take a look around. Do a web search. You know, in San Francisco, there's a foraging, foragingsf, I think it is, .org.
Interesting.
And there's like a club kind of thing. And so, like, all you homebrewers, I think you'd dig it, you know. And mycology.com, I think, or .org, there's a whole list of all the different local groups and chapters that you can get involved with and get wild mushrooms, because when it starts raining like this, all the mushrooms start popping up and
Cool.
So a lot of fun stuff there. But so you think back to the old days, and you know, these guys would go out hunting, and they would just find these turkeys. And the turkeys that we get today are very, very different. They are, you know, huge breeding, you know, as far as what's happened to get a better breast, because people like breast meat, and I don't understand why, but you know.
Yeah.
And I've always liked the dark meat. I don't know about you.
I'll take it all. I don't care.
But the heritage turkeys are really kind of fun. We talked about that a little bit last year, but this year it was really nice. I was actually able to sit down with Jim Reichard from Sonoma Poultry, and you know, Jim's a really cool guy because one, he's been in the duck business forever. You know, it's actually a family business that he's in, but it's also kind of neat too because he's really all about slow food, and that's kind of one of the main themes of this show is really getting back to basics and really slowing down and thinking about what we're eating. And you know, I really want to say thank you to all those emails I've been getting lately about people saying, hey, you're actually making me think a little bit more about what I eat and how I eat and how I feed my family. And that's, you know, another sub point of why we do the show is to help people become more educated about things that not a lot of people talk about. And Jim is one of those guys who is heavily connected. I mean, this is a guy who, he's on so many different boards of the heritage breed, you know, to really protect the genetic species of these different animals, not just turkeys, but also pigs, all the way to cows. I mean, as simple as it seems, we're actually losing a lot of our genetic, you know, material because of all these breedings. And if people don't buy these products, guess what? They disappear because it's all about money.
Yeah.
And we forget about how something actually could have a little bit more flavor. You know, it's not just the free range. It's not just a wild turkey, which are fun. But these heritage birds, and there's a whole bunch of different types. You could do a quick web search, and a whole bunch will pop up on. But I got a nice little interview that we're going to play here with Jim and I talking about slow foods and just a lot of the things that kind of go with that, and also heritage turkeys. So here we go. So I'm sitting with Jim Reichard from Sonoma Poultry, and I'm talking to him about heritage turkeys and, you know, some of these other breeds and slow food and a whole bunch of stuff that Jim's involved with, I think is really, you know, helpful for all of us to understand not only the lineage, but also why these products still exist. And if we don't support them, they'll kind of go away. And these are the way that things were done, and love to get your thoughts on this, Jim.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, the slow food started out, you know, when I've been raised on a farm and been living the whole farm thing for forever. Even I left for a while but came back by choice. So I got involved with slow foods, and I'm a convivial leader at Slow Food Russian River. And you know what drew it to me was that they were identifying products and lifestyles and animals that had the possibility of going away. And basically, instead of trying to underwrite them, well, instead of trying to control it, they tried to build a market for each one of these things. So it could even be a process of making something. So if we educate everybody to enough of a degree that these are really nice things, then it builds market for that person and they can continue their lifestyle. So that attracted me a lot, as opposed to just throwing money at something. It's like trying to work something for it.
And it's great to kind of have that background, you know, and that approach to it, because I think that that really has helped, you know, not only educate people, but also make it into a market.
Right. And, you know, they've been very successful here in Sonoma County. We've had a project to save the Gravenstein apples. So, you know, because they were in danger of all getting pulled out for vineyards, not that I have anything against vineyards by any means, but it's nice to save part of our history here in the county of the Gravenstein apples. So when the people that were making the juice and the applesauce pulled out, all these vineyards had no place, or all the orchards had no place to take their apples. So that was a case where, okay, well, let's put together a marketing program. Let's see if we can band together the farmers. Let's get involved. Let's get restaurants to do it. The Gravenstein, in spite of how wonderful it is, it doesn't ship very well because it browns, it bruises easily. And it's got a very short window of being available in the market. So you work with all those things and try to keep it. And now I think we've stabilized the orchards that we have left. So that type of thing then switches over to animals in addition. Slow Food USA realized that the heritage turkeys in this country were on the verge of disappearing, you know, so that entire genetic background would go away. So about 7-8 years ago, they put the call out to all the conviviums to try to find people, and I got a call to see whether I would raise the turkeys, and which I didn't. But, you know, we tried to have a commercial guy do it 1 year, and then that didn't really work out for him. So then a lady named Randy Seidner, who's a convivium leader in Russian River, she had the idea of approaching the 4-H clubs. They had a poultry 4-H club separate from the regular club, and whether they would do it, and then through Slow Food, we would market it, and we would supply the food for them and everything, and get a project going, and it's been going very well. It's different breeds. We have one family who's actually breeding the turkeys, you know, so it's the hope is to find a young farmer that will want to take it on as a lifestyle and to actually build it to a point where there's a market for it, he can make a good living from it, he or she, and help continue the breed that way. And it's been a national project as far as the heritage breeds, and it's been really successful. People are really recognizing once you try one of these turkeys, they're amazing.
Now, I think it's interesting, too, because as a chef, you know, it's interesting what we look for a product and everything else, you know, as far as yield and, you know, bone-to-meat ratio and all these other things. But yet, one of the things that I think that we forget about is flavor. And I think a lot of these turkeys that have been bred, that we find the butterball, if you will, you know, big giant breast, you know, smaller legs, you know, definitely, you know, a very consistent product. But yet I struggle because we're starting to lose some of the variety in our just diet. And I think that, you know, keeping these varieties around to have diversity, you know, amongst just, you know, a standard turkey versus a few of these different breeds and the flavor profiles that they bring, you know, because if not, people doing these things, whether it's the 4-H or an actual business, you know, I think it's really sad when these, you know, options just aren't there anymore, and then you can't really bring them back, you know?
Well, I think it's a part of, it goes back to the Department of Agriculture under Earl Butz. Basically, he said, if you aren't getting bigger, you need to get out of the way. And that whole concept has gone through agriculture in the last 40 years. So, you know, the commercial guys, they think that the United States wants more protein, less cost, and they've basically focused everything on that, not necessarily on flavor or diversity. So they've created a bird that is amazing. I mean, it takes the protein that they feed it, turns it into a piece of meat for very good money. Yeah, you know, the feed ratio to the meat ratio is really, really good. But they've lost contact with all the flavors, all the diversity of the different breeds and stuff.
Even the texture of the meat.
Yeah, it's totally different. And they just haven't realized or it's worked for them. And general agriculture just kind of works that way, to kind of push it past what maybe normally it should have gone. So as part of, I'm also involved in the American Livestock Breed Conservancy, and they're about preserving livestock breeds, because if we lose all this genetic background, you can't get it back. Once it's gone, it's gone. So part of their mission is to make sure all these animals have a job out there, because you don't want animals just sitting in a zoo. You know, I mean, that works for looking at them, but all the animals need to have a reason for being, a purpose. And so the heritage turkeys, that's an easy one. And then there's other, you know, there's sheep, there's pigs, there's cows and stuff. So we all have to either support them in their value, not just because they're different, but because they're different, but because they are different, if you will. It's hard to say.
Well, and I think that's a great point, because they are different, and also enjoying the diversity versus having the same thing over and over and over again. You know, I mean, I think that diversity, even in, you know, humanity, you know, and how we eat, you know, we used to be nomads and all these other things before we started domesticating all of our animals. And even as we domesticate them. You know, yes, this one might be a little bit better, but we don't want to forget about all these other ones that, you know, have a place too at our table.
Right. I was at a food event in San Francisco a couple years back, and this pig farmer from Iowa, well, he was, you know, well up into the company, he says, yeah, we're right on the edge of being able to do cloned pigs, you know, and we'll basically have the same pig everywhere. And you think we can get a market for that? And I said, well, not in this crowd, you know. Yeah. I'm sure there's a unfortunately, I'm sure there's a market for it, but I don't think I'd bring it up here very loudly. But that's really the way they're going. I mean, even in a totally different direction, I saw a show on a tequila producer, El Jimador. I believe it was El Jimador. And they cloned all their agave plants so they could harvest them with machines, as opposed to letting them kind of grow naturally in Mexico. And so El Jimador is the name of that is named after the guy that's harvesting the crowns of agave, and they've eliminated him. So it's like, wait a minute, does this make sense? You know, maybe there's room for a little bit of variety out there.
That's funny, because they actually take that person out of the equation. Yeah. But that's what I think is interesting, too, is because I think we're becoming smarter than we really think that we are. I mean, I really struggle with a lot of this, even GMO labeling and all these other issues that are regarded to what we buy and to know what we're buying and to be educated as a consumer and not just as, you know, a guy who's made the decision for us and we don't have to have that choice anymore.
Right, the whole GMO labeling thing, that's, you know, somebody said, okay, it's substantially the same or essentially the same product, so we don't have to label it. But that's from, you know, possibly just a scientific view of what the product is, as opposed to letting us have a choice in maybe we want it raised in a different way. I mean, if you could say organic, and it could well be the same product, you know, from a, if you broke it down from a chemical point of view, but you're making that choice that you want it raised organically, maybe not that the product's going to be different. You know, we can argue about that, but there is going to be a difference on the treatment to land. So it's the same argument for me. It just allows you a choice. The hormones in milk, you know, they say it's the same either way, but the milk might be the same, but the treatment to the cows is totally different. So, you know, give us that choice. And if the American public wants it, then okay, you know, sell it. But if you can't keep a business going with it except by not being able to say what's in it, you know, that's a little backwards to me.
So speaking of, like, the slow food movement and what they're doing to help, you know, promote these different products that are more heirloom in nature. And, you know, I mean, the example of the Gravenstein apple, I think, is perfect, because what they could get per bushel of apples versus per ton of grapes was radically different. And so many, you know, orchards just got demolished because, you know, hey, we could put in grapes and switch over to that. But then, you know, is it more greed? Is it more the education component to help people understand some of these things? Because, you know, I'm even, like, with what you do in your ducks, I mean, you have a duck breast that's consistent all the time. It's juicy, it's flavorful, it has, you know, great texture, you know, all these different things that go into how you raise your ducks. And I mean, I know from a cost standpoint, you know, obviously it works for you since you're still in business, but yet it's not just about profit and greed. You know, I mean, I think that there's this value standpoint that I think is kind of an interesting thing.
Yeah, I mean, I could make probably more money if I just went into a straight commercial product with the ducks, and I'm really happy to be doing a product that I think is sustainable, that is raised in a way that I can stand behind and follow. As far as tearing out orchards, I don't think anyone, you know, I kind of jumped the fence a little bit on that one, because I don't think anyone should have to keep something that isn't making them money. However, at the same time, if we can do value-added products, if we can figure out how to get that farmer more money, then he'll keep them by choice. It shouldn't be something mandated to him. It should be something that hopefully we can make, you know, his cyst-making, you know, guide, however you want to phrase that, so that he can make profit on it without subsidies, without anything else. It's got to be a way of making that happen.
But do you think some of that too, though, is to have the support behind and the marketing advertising component? You know, because do people really understand, like, you know, okay, this is a Fuji versus a Granny Smith versus a Blackburn or a Black Arkansas, you know, apple? And I mean, they're all different, just like the heirloom turkeys. I mean, they're different breeds, you know, their heritage, they're the old school. I mean, this is what probably the Pilgrims were eating, you know, and there's something historical about that that I think we're forgetting about.
Yeah, I think people do need to be made aware, and slowly and surely that's what we're doing, you know, that these apples are different. They aren't your Red Delicious that is just going to sit there, doesn't maybe have a bruise or a little mark on it or whatever. That these apples just taste better because they're different stock. They got different properties. You use them for different things. You use them at different times of the year. Right now, a lot of the juice comes into the United States from China. And that doesn't seem to make sense. And, you know, I can sort of okay with apples from Washington, but, you know, maybe after we keep all the apple farmers here in business, you know. So, but the grocery stores don't do anything unless they're asked to. They're going to provide the same Red Delicious apple, you know, because that's what sells, and boom, it goes along, and there's no reason for them to change because they're making money on it, and there's not enough people asking for anything else. Now, the interesting thing, bananas with the Cavendish banana is got a disease problem or a fungus problem, whatever it is, and it's going to go away. Probably, I don't know what the timeline is, but it's 5-10 years, and they don't really have a substitute for it. And as in the United States, we eat a lot of bananas, and they don't have anything to back it up, and they haven't really figured out what to do yet, as far as I know. So that's a case where, without the genetic diversity, you know, almost everything we eat is a Cavendish, and there's nothing to replace it. You know, the cows in this country, there's only like 99% of the milk cows in this country are from 8 families of breeding cows. So because of the artificially... No, just the Holsteins.
Oh, okay.
There's only 8 families of Holsteins, 8 family genetic lines for the entire country.
Really?
So if there's a disease problem or a genetic problem, we have no milk cows left. And if we don't maintain some of the breeds that other breeds, you know, it's all... we're going to be in a deep pile, and that's the problem with putting everything in one basket.
Well, that actually happened with grapes not that many years ago, where they have to start grafting because of diseases, you know, and you start to look at all these diversity issues, plus, you know, you look at what happens when you get a large, you know, volume of, you know, this or that, you know, product, and what can happen, you know, Mother Nature kind of taking it back, if you will. It's kind of interesting.
Yeah, the whole monoculture is just a bad thing in general. You know, we need a diverse farm, you know, across the country, you know, where in the Midwest, where there used to be a lot of different, even if they were all grain crops, there were different grain crops. Right now, corn has taken over everything, and, you know, so that's basically all states are doing, like 95% corn, you know, wall to wall. And it could be really ugly here if we aren't careful.
No, it's interesting. I mean, this obviously this conversation could go a lot longer because there's so many different facets to it. But you know, I think it's really interesting just to get people to go back and do some research and think about what they're getting and is that the best product? And, you know, obviously for the producer to make it, it's the best product, but is that the best one for your family and for what you want it to be? Because, you know, I look at Thanksgiving as, you know, a great way to celebrate the year and the harvest, and it's a seasonal thing. You know, you don't have Thanksgiving in, you know, February or March. It just doesn't seem right, you know, and in the middle of summer, it doesn't seem to fit either. But, you know, we'd have a turkey sandwich at any time, but, you know, to have a really nice Thanksgiving turkey and a feast and what that is to be communal and get your family together and friends together and celebrate, you know, and to have something special and to have something as like a heritage turkey or a really good duck or a goose, you know, I think it's something just a completely appropriate way to celebrate with something special.
Absolutely. You know, part of the whole slow food thing is it isn't just about saving breeds and everything. It's about spending time with your family, sitting down, about a table. Slow down. Don't eat every meal behind a steering wheel of a car in a drive-thru. Sit down with your family, open a bottle of wine, enjoy nice food, actually enjoy the preparation of the food. And that's a big tenet of slow food that I think is getting a little bit lost right now, but it was part of what it was all formed around.
Well, that's still what I stand behind, and it's great, too, because, you know, when people come to my dinners, you know, I'm asking them to spend 3, 4, 5, sometimes 6 hours, depending on how many courses it is and what we can do to slow people down and just enjoy what's in front of them and the, you know, people sitting next to them and the beverage that's in that glass. And I think it's those small things, and that's more of a philosophical standpoint, but I think it's something that, you know, it's really important to slow down and, you know, enjoy and chew and enjoy what that is. Because sometimes if you really did slow down, I don't think you'd really want to be eating what you were eating. So,
yeah, you know, think about the future when you're making your buying choices. You know, it isn't all about the 29-cent hamburger. You know, you got to think that, you know, maybe there's more to it. Maybe you got a little bit more responsibility in your buying power. And so go ahead and do these other things. It doesn't have to be big. You don't have to, you know, we – probably too much protein as it is anyhow. So buy some different vegetables. You know, buy a really nice piece of meat, buy a grass-fed piece of meat, but buy less of it and do it as a portion of a thing. You don't have to have a 12-ounce porterhouse, you know.
Nah, it's a good point, Jim. Well, again, I really appreciate your time. It's always great to sit down with you and talk, and it's great to get this all on audio. So
thanks for being here. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Jim. Again, I mean, I feel so fortunate to have a guy like that in my backyard and a guy I really look up to. And, you know, he's good friends with Vinny and Natalie, and we always make jokes about them. But I really think his points are so poignant to where we're at right now as a society and what we're doing and the monoculture. And, you know, I really liked his point, too, about just enjoying the process of cooking and slowing down. And I really think that that's a real key philosophical point that we forget sometimes about how we eat and what we do this time of year, and to really celebrate. And it really touched me a lot, that whole interview, because to really slow down and think about the process of making food. I mean, I take it for granted, and we all have to eat, so we all kind of take it for granted, but yet make it fun, celebrate.
Yeah. Great interview. Very well-spoken guy and knowledgeable about his trade. So nice to hear a couple of options of what we can and should be thinking about when buying food for our families, and certainly at this holiday season. Let's take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll talk about kind of how to use some of that food that you can go buy, some of this good stuff that Jim was telling us about, and put it on your table. And don't forget, this is a two-part episode, so we got more of this holiday action to come just after this one. So hang in there. Here's new music from The Trophy Fire, Medicate, off their new album, Modern Hearts.
Right on.
Small room, bright lights, I'm Jamel Zanishev, and in addition to my work on the Brewing Network, I write the style profile column in every issue of Brew Your Own magazine.
Hi, I'm Sean Paxton, and when I'm not prepping for the Home Brewed Chef on the Brewing Network, you can find me writing articles on how to cook with your home brew for Brew Your Own magazine.
Greetings, cretins. This is John Palmer, and when I'm not writing for Brew Your Own, I'm reading it.
John Palmer, Sean Paxton, Jamil Zainashev. If you love listening to them on the Brewing Network, you'll love reading their articles, tips, and recipes in the pages of Brew Your Own magazine. Join Jamil, John, and Sean 8 times a year in Brew Your Own. And when you subscribe to BYO on the Brewing Network website, half of your subscription price goes right back to the BN to support great beer and food programming. So sign up for Brew Your Own magazine through the BN website today so you can listen and read your way to better homebrew.
Now back to the show that turns food into, oh my God, it's the Homebrewed Chef with Sean Paxton.
All right, thanks for sticking with us. And back here with Sean Z. Paxton on the Homebrewed Chef to talk a little more about what we should put on our table this holiday season, both Thanksgiving and a little Christmas time coming up.
Yeah, I mean, this is where, to me, it's just such a fun time to get together and enjoy each other's company and get in the kitchen and spend all day in the kitchen. And to me, it's always fun when there's a lot of people in the kitchen and there's this kind of energy and synergy that kind of builds. And, oh, it's just a great time. You know, and I think, too, the last interview with Jim gives you a lot to think about, like what you actually put on your table. And that was really one of the main points of the show that I really wanted to come across that we didn't quite talk about last year, because last year's show, November 18th, we really talked a lot about how to smoke your bird, how to brine your bird, you know, even how to sous vide your bird. You know, we talked all kinds of ideas to really present the turkey. But, you know, I really wanted to talk a lot more about what type of turkey you get. You know, last year I did a Nyman Ranch turkey, and it was just a beautiful, rich flavored turkey that really the commercial turkey did not. I mean, we actually had 3 turkeys last year at my Thanksgiving. And it was interesting because that heritage turkey side by side was a whole different product. Mm. It actually was so much richer in flavor, and you really didn't need to eat as much. So a smaller bird is a little bit better. I mean, granted, if you like leftovers, you know, get a little bit bigger. But
sure,
they're not huge turkeys, though. You're not going to find a 30, 40, 50-pound heritage turkey unless okay. you really look and you raise it yourself.
You know, for a lot of families, that sounds perfect. You know, you don't have the whole world coming over to your house for Thanksgiving, and you got more food that you can fit in your refrigerator at the
or
end of the meal.
Your oven, because a 50-pound turkey
yeah.
does not fit in most ovens.
Yeah.
even commercial ovens, it's hard to get that one that big. The biggest one I've ever cooked was a 35-pound turkey.
Wow.
And let me tell you, getting that thing in and out of the oven when it was fully, you know.
I bet.
Big. Big. I've cooked way too many turkeys in my lifetime.
Yeah.
I remember there's one year where I cooked 68 turkeys.
Wow.
That's a lot of turkey.
Yeah.
But let me tell you, when turkey was served at Thanksgiving, I still ate it. So,
you do like your turkey.
Well, it's fun because when do you roast a whole animal? And that's kind of what I think is fun because, you know, it is a fowl and, you know, it's an animal and respect it, enjoy it, you know, treat it right. And the biggest thing I'll tell you is use an instant read thermometer with a probe. Really important. That will really secure outside of brining your turkey. The cooking of the turkey is very important. 300, 325 degrees is a really good temperature, depending on the size of the bird.
This is what the internal temperature of the
internal,
bird should be.
Well, no, that's the oven temp.
The oven temp, oh.
The internal temp, really pull the turkey at 160.
Okay. Phew, boy, did I have that wrong.
Whoa, that is a dry turkey.
It's like eating dust. Okay, hey, sorry. So 325 for the oven, got
it. Yes. Radically different.
Okay, and 165, you said?
No, 160.
160,
because
okay.
What will happen, it's called carryover, and basically what happens is the turkey itself, you're measuring the internal temperature. The external temperature is very different, like what we talked about when you cook a steak, you know, versus sous vide versus on the stove or on a grill.
Okay.
And so the residual heat will keep cooking that turkey for quite a while. You'll go up at least another 5 degrees.
Wow.
So all those cookbooks that are out there, I mean, there's a lot of cookbooks that people have on your shelves that your mom used, your grandma used, even some new ones that still say 180. And 180, I mean, it's salmonella is dead at 160.
It is. Okay.
I mean, 165 is what they say. And then you can hold it at 140 for as long as you want. You know, not a day, but, you know, 4 hours or so. But, yeah, 160, if you pull it, it's going to go up to 165, and you're going to be fine.
Okay.
Really. But this is also, too, where it's important to look at the breast versus the thigh meat. So it's good to take a temperature reading of both. So get a good thermometer. Get one of those ones with a little probe, and you can actually not even have to open your oven door, because the more you open that oven door to baste your turkey and stuff, you're just letting a lot of the heat out, and you just take it a lot longer. And depending on how many ovens you have in your house, you know, try to do your pies and all the other stuff that needs to be baked ahead of time, and then go ahead and cook your turkey, and then you can let it rest out on the counter an hour before you have to serve it and carve it, because actually that's going to be a better turkey, because it's going to allow the juices to redistribute, and when you carve it, it's not going to have this big pool of juice all over your cutting board, which you really want that to be in your turkey.
Good point. So it can really sit out for an hour.
Oh, easy. I mean, 4 hours before you even have to think about even getting sick. So the temperature as far as...
I guess I mean even serving temperature. If you wrap it in foil, you're confident that even after an hour, that meat is still plenty warm to...
You have a 20-pound, 22-pound turkey.
Yeah, okay.
Wrapped in foil.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. It's going to hold up for quite a while.
And that's an...
And it's not like your kitchen's, you know, 32 below. I mean, it's, you know, I don't know what kitchen you can work it in, but...
Well, it depends on how cheap I'm feeling that holiday, right? Have I turned the heat on for the family or not? And I also really like the point that you make about the redistribution of the juices, because...
That's the key.
Boy, do I know what you're talking about when you put it down on
the
cutting board and it runs all over the place. I want to eat
why.
That.
Same with a steak. I mean, you know, even a burger.
So it just kind of ends up redistributing through the meat a little bit, you're saying?
Yeah, because think about what's happening. When you flex a muscle, you're squeezing it. And in that squeezing process, which is essentially... You're not quite doing it, but it's very similar. You know, it's almost like you're flexing the muscle tissue, and it's squeezing all
the
juice
out. Like you're wringing it out.
Exactly.
Okay.
And as the temperature lowers, it relaxes. And that's what makes sous vide cooking so much better on certain types of things, especially like lobster. Like butter poached lobster is amazing when it's sous vide, because it's the most tender it just melts in your mouth. Same with shrimp, fish. You can do some really interesting things that you can actually really play with the texture of things. Talking about beef short ribs earlier, I did ones where I've added in like a smoked porter and some thyme, bay leaf, salt, pepper, keeping the seasonings really simple on the short rib, and you can actually cook it at like 131 degrees for 48 hours, 2 days.
Wow.
But when do you get a short rib that's medium rare? So you've actually still denatured the sinuous tissue that makes that meat tough when it's more rare or medium rare. You still break it down just like you have when you've braised it for 4 hours or 6 hours at 325 degrees, but you get all that texture and flavor and juiciness, and it's still pink on the inside.
Okay.
So it's kind of a fun twist and something kind of fun to do as far as, you know, a medium rare short rib you don't see very often.
All right.
So, yeah, so a lot of fun stuff there. Also, you know, when you're thinking about your holiday meal, really stop and think about all these flavors. And, you know, you can have two different kinds of mashed potatoes. You can have your stuffing. You got your green bean casserole. You got your cranberry sauce. Really stop and think. It's not one beer. It's multiple beers. You know, really think about, you know, because there's so many beers right now on the market. It's actually hard to keep up.
Yeah.
But that's what's great. I'm not complaining at all.
No,
but
this is a blessing.
There's so many wonderful beers right now that will go great with your turkey. You know, if you do ham instead, you can do a whole bunch of different beers with ham, you know, and really stop and think about what you're going to be serving at your table. You know, if you have roasted sweet potatoes, you know, if you have, you know, Scotch ale works great with those, you know, and Scotch ale will work great with your turkey. Add a little smokiness, a little bit of peat, as well as the texture of that beer being a little thicker, you know, because turkey, you know, especially like the dark meat, or really pair well with that. You know, your brown ales, you know, the porters might be a little strong, but depending on your stuffing, that might work really well.
Mm.
You know, I always do like a wild mushroom gravy that I make with Doppelbock, and I think that's just a fun beer to pair with as well, or a nice Bock. Some of these pumpkin beers, actually, there's some really nice ones on the market right now, and those were kind of fun, too, with that pumpkin pie kind of thing. And this is also where, too, I would encourage you to play around with blending your beers. So take two different commercial beers and blend them together. Think about, like, you know, that holiday spice beer that might be just a little bit too heavy on the spices and the aromatics that are going into it.
Yeah.
And blend that with a pumpkin ale that's a little bit more subdued.
Okay.
And you'll find a nice balance, whether it's 60-40, 70-30, and you can actually create a real fun kind of cocktail that's something kind of different.
Great idea.
So that's also something kind of fun and different. So,
okay. And in part two, we are going to give you more on the beer pairing and beer usage side. So just hang in there a few minutes for that, and we'll cover that for you as well. So, well, great job. You know, even just getting us some good information about, you know, what to purchase is very helpful to kind of figure out what to put on the table. And then I don't want people to forget that last year at this time, we spent a good almost 3 hours in here talking about how to cook this stuff. So don't feel like we're leaving you out in the cold about how to cook it. Go back to last year's November episode, and you can tune in to the. It's essentially the same things we're talking about going to buy, and then telling you how to cook it. And Sean's got real specific. So
we got a whole bunch of stuff on that show, and then even some of the other shows in the archives on the session. We did a few of that show. It's kind of funny how many times you've talked holidays and Thanksgiving.
Well, it's your favorite. I know it's one of your favorites. So, all right, so do that just so you don't feel, you know, if you really need some good recipe instruction, then our last year's show is there and it's just great. But take some of the tips that Sean talked about buying today and that Jim talked about going and looking for and then using in those recipes that you can also find on thehomebrewchef.com.
Yeah, and actually I was going to suggest that because this is the time to start thinking about the strategy of what you're going to get, how you're going to get it, when you're going to pick it up, you know, to put your orders in now on some of the stuff because there are limited quantities of these turkeys that are the different varieties in your butterball. Plus, if you follow me on Twitter, Homebrew Chef, also on Google Plus now, and also on, I have a fan page on Facebook. I'll be posting a whole bunch of recipes and links for stuff. So that's a great way to follow me, as well as homebrewchef.com.
Perfect.
So, yeah.
All right. Before we move on to part two of this, there's just a couple of things left to do. And one of them is our style spotlight.
Yes.
What do we have?
We are very fortunate. Actually, you were very fortunate while I was cooking to talk to Roger Davis, Mr. Triple Rock. It's actually funny. I'm actually saying Triple Rock. Drake's all the time. But he has been doing some really fun stuff. And, you know, the beer that he did with Nate was just awesome for the Pro-Am.
With Nathan Smith. Yeah. They did the Dankness, it's called.
Oh.
Just talked about that on Kenny Brewitt this week. In fact, you can listen to the show right now on thebrewingnetwork.com, download the Dankness, and hear Roger and Nate talk about that beer.
When I had that beer, actually, I had to text Nathan and say, could you put some more hops in this? He's like, I'll be right over.
Well, let me tell you this. And now, I know the style of beer we have him talk about is a wet hop beer, right?
Wet hop or a harvest?
A harvest ale.
So,
and I just wanted to point out, you know, before we go to it too, especially as you're giving him kind of kudos, to me, Roger is one of the hop pioneers, the hop guys in our beer industry. He really is. I think he's a bit understated in terms of how well that man uses hops. He's great at it. He's knowledgeable. He pays attention to it. And for me, a person who's shied away a little bit from the hoppy bitter beers, his are the ones I still can gravitate to, because he's not big on the bitter side. He's just big on the use of hops and their flavor and their aroma. And I think he does an awesome job.
Yeah, and here's Roger talking about Harvest Ales.
All right, I'm here with Roger Davis from Triple Rock Brewing Company. And one of the beers that he brought to our beer festival today, we're out at Downtown Joe's for a taste of North Bay beers. And one of the beers he brought us was a Harvest Ale. So our style spotlight today is what a Harvest Ale is. So Roger, could you explain the style Harvest Ale?
Well, there's many different interpretations of what a harvest ale is. The way that I interpret a harvest ale is that excuse me.
There's some great scenery at the festival today.
Yes, my wife just walked by. A harvest ale, in my opinion, is that anything that is made with a hop that is picked either that day or the day after and used in the brew kettle. A lot of people that I've talked to have said that a wet hopped ale is something that you use those same hops in the kettle.
So bittering and everything.
Exactly. But I don't do that. The one that I brought today is bittered with pellets and a little bit of pellets for the flavor, and then just a shit ton. And let me regurgitate that. A shit ton of fresh hops at the end. To basically just give you the whole aroma of what that beer is all about and what that hop's all about.
Okay.
Actually, so, more about the hop than the beer.
So for you, a harvest ale can easily use pellets in the kettle as long as you're showcasing the wet hop as your aroma and flavor.
Yes. But then a wet hop beer would be something that, or a wet hops would be something that's wet hops all the way through. Because wet hop essentially means that there's a lot of moisture still in the hop, and it's being picked right there. excuse me. I mean, for us, we're set up for pellets at Triple Rock. That we can't actually use the wet hop. The mass of the hop would just clog our heat exchanger quickly, and we just don't want that to happen, obviously. Okay. So so we use pellets during the boil, and then we send it up to the mash tun, where we have a lot of hops, wet hops, that were just sent. by Shent, I meant sent overnight to us, and we use them that day. So they're essentially, I would say, somewhere in the vicinity of 12 to maybe 18 hours off the vine before we use them.
Okay. And that is Roger Davis's version of a harvest ale. My only other question is, when you say a shit ton, is it a metric shit ton?
No, it's actually a shit ton.
Just a shit.
Yeah, it's just... No, seriously, if you take a shit, and then you graduate that up to a ton, it's what we use.
Thank you very much. There you go, Roger Davis.
Oh, man.
I love
that guy.
Love him.
He is really a pioneer, I think. He does some really fun stuff, and his beers are very balanced, and they have a very unique, in a very positive way, profile of the hop. It's not blended so far down where you can't discern this hop variety to that hop variety, but yet there's a synergy there.
Yeah.
And he does a great job. And it's interesting, too, because, you know, wet hop beers, harvest ales, are really a trip beer because... You know, if you're using Cascade or, you know, like at Sierra Nevada when they do their Harvest Ale, which, you know, to me, that is just one of my favorite beers this time of year. It's just such a beautiful beer. Plus, you know, you look at Roger's beers that he's done with the wet hop, you know, and everybody's getting different types of hops. And so this is what makes it really hard on the pairing side because there's so many different flavor attributes. But you do definitely get a little bit more of that green, a little bit more grassy, a little bit more, not straw per se, but you kind of get that undertone of vegetal without being unpleasant. And so this is where, you know, you can do a lot of different things with it. I really like it with cheese, like a good brie that kind of has that mushroomy, earthy kind of rind. And then you get that real creaminess in the center, and that grassiness really plays that up really nicely. You could also do, you know, blue cheese, I think, would work really well as well. But again, it all depends on the type of hops. So, you know, on the food side, you know, like... Salume, you know, a good, you know, nice salami or cured meat, I think would work really well too. You know, even like a lardo where it's real fatty and you kind of get that bright bitterness that kind of, you know, it's not dank, I wouldn't say. Again, it depends on what type of hops you're using, but usually it's a lot more aromatic than bitter because they're usually putting them in at the very end and, like, you know, that metric shit ton, you know, that's going in at the end there. So it kind of changes things up a little bit. So, but really want to thank Roger and Triple Rock for having that beer because these are fun beers that we're still experimenting a lot with too, as far as style and great things to find. And it's a very seasonal beer. So,
yep.
Wet hop beers.
I think he experiments a lot with hops, but I think he also experiments.
I think he experiments a lot. Period.
Yeah. But I think he experiments from a knowledgeable side, right? He's not, he's a little more like you as a chef, where he's not just throwing a bunch of things in willy nilly. He experiments from a side.
There's
where
a design.
Yeah, there's some design to it, and he's just real good at it. So thanks again to Roger for talking to us about that.
And speaking of design, you are drinking my design.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about that before we moved on to the next show, too. You've just poured me a beer dubbed Sexy Mexi. Do I have that right?
You do.
What is Sexy Mexi? What am I drinking?
Well, I had the privilege of brewing with Tanya Cornett again from Ben Brewing Company.
Speaking of sexy, I like Tanya.
She's a sweetheart.
Brewing is great, and she's sexy.
So talented.
Yeah.
Really great brewer, and... It's really interesting to actually brew with a female brewer. She has a very different perspective, not just trying to prove herself, but also she tastes differently. And I really enjoy how our conversations go and how we design a recipe together. And Sexy Mexi is basically an imperial milk stout. Hmm. I don't see that style very often. Very few people have actually, I think, even tried it or attempted it. The idea was to do something different than a Russian Imperial Stout. And this beer was actually designed to be more of a mood or event beer. So the idea at Ben Brewing, you know, since they're right there by Mount Bachelor, was the idea is that you just finish skiing the slopes of Mount Bachelor and you don't really feel like a cocktail. You don't really want hot chocolate either. And you're sitting by the fireplace and you kind of want something that's going to kind of warm you up, but kind of just be a nice sipping beer that just fun flavors that kind of roll on your tongue.
Wow, when you put it that way, I think you nailed it.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I was really stoked because that was, I mean, this was a really difficult recipe to create because we basically wanted to do a Mexican hot chocolate into a beer.
Okay.
So the idea was with a Mexican chocolate, you get some chilies, you get some cinnamon, you get some spices in there, but nothing's so overt that it takes it out of balance.
No, it still tastes like chocolate.
Because it's a chocolate. I mean, it's a Mexican chocolate.
Yeah.
You know, and so we actually brewed a just huge, like 12.5% imperial milk stout. Took not quite a Russian imperial stout as a base, and then we put in some ancho chilies and some cinnamon and some orange peel actually into the mash. We actually added in some chocolate in there too, Mexican chocolate, and we had a couple different varieties. And then we sparged it, we brought it to a boil, and we just used Magnum at 90 minutes. So there was no other hop additions because we didn't really want it to be a hop-forward imperial stout or milk stout. And then what we did is we did three different kinds of cinnamon. We did a Ceylon cinnamon, a Canela cinnamon, which is a Mexican cinnamon, and we also did a Vietnamese Saigon cinnamon. And each one's a little bit different. And, you know, cinnamon in itself, you think about red hot candies, they have a lot of flavor. So we didn't want it to be too spicy from that. But the anchos are really nice because, you know, it's a dried chili that, to me, I get a lot of cherry, you get a little bit of spice from it, but that with the cinnamon starts to bring up a little bit more spice. And then we use three different kinds of orange peel, sweet, bitter, and we actually got whole slices of dehydrated orange. So you got the pith as well as the orange flesh itself. And we basically did a combo with Mexican vanilla beans, and we used that at 15 and at 5 and at knockout, just to really bring those oils and stuff home and not, you know, be all volatile and just boil off. And we put a little bit more anchos in there as well. And this has actually been sitting for almost a year. And so I'm going to go up there again for Thanksgiving, and we're going to do a little blending. And next month, you'll be able to actually buy this beer.
It's awesome.
Yeah, it's kind of fun because there's just a little bit of that tickle, that little bit of heat on your tongue.
And even that didn't come until after several sips.
Yeah.
The heat doesn't appear right away. It appears.
And as it warms up, it actually becomes a little bit more dominant.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's that little bit of cinnamon kind of barky kind of thing on the sides of your tongue, which I kind of enjoy, and it kind of plays up the roast component because you think about the astringency of the roast.
But all of it is so subtle, it really does tie together well. The orange and the, in fact, I wouldn't, you know, when you tell me that there's cinnamon in a beer,
yeah,
you'd think it'd be the first thing you could pick out. It's a
like
strong
a holiday
spice
beer. Yeah,
I wouldn't have picked it out until you told me. I wouldn't have picked out the orange, I guess a little bit, but kind of all
the
tied
orange
together.
It's the brightness it's, you know, bringing that acid to it, essentially. And then we used chocolate wheat to really get that nice cocoa. We used some chocolate malt, but it was actually more predominantly chocolate wheat to really get that flavor. We were playing around. I just had never really brewed with chocolate rye, and I thought that spiciness of the rye and that creaminess of the rye would have been kind of fun. And one of the things that we did at the very, very end of the boil, just because, you know, it's a Mexican-style beer, we put a little dulce de leche, which is the goat milk that's been simmered very low and slow to basically make a caramel, so the lactose caramelizes, and we put a lot of lactose in this beer too, so there's a nice little body to it too, but it dries out at the end, which I'm really, really pleased with.
Fantastic beer. Well done, Tanya and Paxton.
Yeah, so it's been kind of fun, and just again to rethink how we brew and that crossover between food and beer. And this was, to me, that beer, because you could do so much with this, tamales to mole to, you know, even just a good old taco.
All right. Well, don't forget, we've got a lot more for you coming up just right after this. Part two of the Holiday Beer Show is coming up right now. If you're a podcast listener, you'll find it at the same time in your iTunes or on the website. You'll be able to download both of these shows simultaneously. If you're listening live, then hang in there with us. We can take your questions from the chat room on the next episode. As always, thanks to our sponsor, Cicerone. You can go to Cicerone.org and find out all the information that you need. Become a certified beer Cicerone. Know more about beer, more about how to serve it, more about how to talk about it, more about how to store it, more about beer in general at Cicerone.org.
That's a lot to learn.
Yeah. There is a lot to learn, isn't there? So, and those guys are doing it the best over at Cicerone, so check it out. You can send your feedback over to homebrewedchef@thebrewingnetwork.com. Go straight to Sean Paxton. We'll try to do it here on the show, and what we can't do here, he tries to get back to you directly. So don't hesitate to send your questions, and thanks for tuning in.
Yeah, definitely.
As always.
I hope this was helpful for you guys, and again, tune in, and we'll be talking a little bit more about turkey and ideas and side dishes and desserts and good stuff.
Absolutely. Stick with us. It is. It's a great season. I'm looking forward to another a great holiday meal inspired by Sean Paxton. So just stick with us and find out more. We got a little bit more coming up right now on The Homebrewed Chef.
Ciao.